My topic is 10 things you should know about socialism, and it's basically based on my book, The Problem of Socialism. And a couple of years ago, Regnery Publishing contacted me. They contacted Tom Woods first, but he said Tom Woods Incorporated keeps them too busy. So he said, call DiLorenzo. So they called me and asked me if I could, because they had been reading these opinion polls. One opinion poll said 69% of people under 30 said they would vote for a socialist for president. And so that's kind of alarming to hear that in America. And so they asked me if I could put together a short book for the millennial generation about, making the case against socialism. And they asked if I could do it in 5 weeks. And I did. Off season, I wasn't teaching. So just all day, every day, 4 weeks, I churned out the book. And so, that's the purpose of the book. And so I thought I'm going to summarize some of the main points about socialism, things you ought to know about socialism. Maybe these are talking points. It'll help you debate your commie roommate back at school or someone like that. Might even help you get kicked out of school. Who knows? Which would be a good thing for some people. So socialism defined, the classic definition in the early 20th century was government ownership of the means of production. So when you see countries becoming more and more socialist, it means their governments have been taking over various means of production. When the British nationalized all of the commanding heights of their economy after World War II, they became more and more socialist. And so they didn't become totally socialist in the central planning sense like the Soviet Union, but they moved, they lurched in the direction of socialism. And now in Friedrich Hayek's famous book, The Road to Serfdom, in the 1976 edition, he argued that over the years, between the early 20th century and then, mid-70s, the definition of socialism had changed. He said that it changed to include the institutions of the welfare state and the progressive income tax, because, in his words, the ostensible goal was always egalitarianism, or the pursuit of equality through forceful governmental coercion, and the means just changed. He said the original means were government ownership of the means of production, and that didn't work out too well. And so they switched to a different means, the welfare state and a progressive income tax. And so that was Hayek's idea. And now if you, I would encourage you, if you're interested in this, read at least some of von Mises' book, Socialism. It's a great classic. It's online. It's for sale here at the Mises Institute. And in the latter chapters of socialism, Mises says that an important part of socialism is what he called destructionism. And in the spirit of Patrick's deciphering of Murray Rothbard's bad handwriting, I wrote it down, Patrick Newman's bad handwriting. I wrote down one of the things that Mises said in the book about destructionism. He said, destruction is the essence of socialism. Socialism produces nothing. It only consumes what the social order, based on private ownership and the means of production, has created. And so when you see politicians today who call themselves socialists advocating reparations for slavery, a guaranteed annual income, free health care for everybody, free education, free this, free that, that's basically what they're doing. They're saying we want to loot and plunder the fruits of past efforts of production under private property and give it away in order to prop us up, ourselves up as with political power and be sort of Uber Santa Claus, just giving everything away. Government is Santa Claus is how I think of it. And so that's what destructionism is. And that, by the way, the group of socialists who came to America in the 1940s, who are known as cultural Marxists, their theory was that the reason why the Europeans did not voluntarily embrace socialism was that they were too wedded to the institutions and ideas of Western civilization, including the ideas of capitalism, in particular, and private property and so forth, and Christianity. They were too wedded to Christianity. Therefore, the ideas and institutions of Western civilization and the ideas of Christianity must be destroyed in order to have socialist utopia. And that, in my view, is why you see all these attacks on the traditional family, always on capitalism for sure, and just the tearing down of monuments and the painting over of murals and things like that. These are all attacks on the institutions of Western civilization, and it's all part of the game plan of destructionism. Okay, so that's socialism. Point number two is socialism will destroy your economic future. I got a laugh last week when the chief of staff of this Cortez woman, the bartender from Westchester County who got elected to Congress by pretending she's from the Bronx, and the author of the Green New Deal, which Bob Murphy's going to talk about later on today, he came out and admitted, he said, it has nothing to do with the climate. It's all about socialism. It's all about socialism. Okay, and so the reason I got a chuckle, it's sort of, I don't know whether to laugh or cry, is that all the young people, all the millennials who are on board with this, the Green New Deal, it's all about destroying their economic future with socialism. That's what it's all about. And at the same time, granting tremendous amounts of power to creatures like this guy, the chief of staff of this woman, the Cortez woman. And that's what it's all about. And so just study history a little bit. The Soviet Union, our friend Yuri Maltsev, who was an advisor to Mikhail Gorbachev, who's lectured here many times, when he defected from the Soviet Union, he started telling our government, the U.S. government, that the size of the U.S. economy was, or the Soviet economy, was no more than 5% of the U.S. economy. At the time, the CIA was telling everybody it was 65%. And also at the time, in the 1989 edition of Paul Samuelson's famous textbook, the Principles of Economics textbook, which was the biggest selling textbook in the world from the 1940s until the 1980s, he predicted that, this was 1989, he predicted that by 2000, the Soviet economy would be bigger than the U.S. economy. That's what mainstream economics was teaching college students in 1989 on the verge of the total collapse of the Soviet Union. But Yuri was right. It was more like 5%. The CIA was wrong. It wasn't 65%. Country after country, Africa after independence, they adopted Soviet socialism and central planning. Their logo was, quote, "Only socialism can save Africa." 40 years later, these African countries were poorer than they were under colonialism. Venezuela today, need I say more? There's going to be a presentation about the disaster that socialism has created in Venezuela on Saturday, and I encourage everybody to go and listen to it. England, after World War II, adopted their version of socialism, Fabian socialism. They nationalized many of the major industries. By the 1970s, the whole world was talking about the British disease because they had ruined their economy, and that's what led to the election of Margaret Thatcher, who promised, who was a student of Hayek, not a formal student, but she read Hayek, and she turned things around quite a bit. She wasn't exactly a Ron Paul, but they did move in the other direction. Argentina adopted its version of socialism in the 1940s and 50s under Perón, and he of course quickly ruined the Argentine economy and was replaced with a coup. And Argentina, like all these other countries, once they destroyed the productive capacity of their country, they tried to bail themselves out by printing money. And Argentina, by the 1980s, had 12,000% price inflation. Okay, Chile, the same thing. The country of Chile adopted socialism in the 1970s. They ended up with 746% inflation in an economy that simply stood still, just destroyed it. And then they were that government was overthrown by a repressive regime after that. So not a happy history of country after country. And you might have noticed that a lot of these countries are democracies. Friedrich Bastiat wrote in his famous essay, The Law, that there's really no difference. If the government imposes a uniform policy on the whole country, a dictator can do it and a legislature can do it. So there's really no difference. You know, you can impose socialism with a legislature like Venezuela did. You don't need dictatorship to have socialism. You don't need the Soviet Union to ruin your economy. Okay. Point number three is you cannot fix socialism. After Bill Clinton left office, there was one of his top economic advisors penned an article in the New York Times arguing that socialism is not such a bad idea. It just needs to be administered by smart people like us. And that's always been the argument by the left that, the people, just the wrong people have managed socialism. Well, that ignores economics. That ignores economics. You cannot fix it. The original explanation for why socialism is economically poisonous was the incentive problem. And, I joke with my principals of economics classes. On the first day, I tell them, here's what we're going to do. I'm going to give seven exams during the course of the 14-week semester. I'm going to add up, and then when I get all the grades, those of you who get the low grades, I'm going to take points away from the good students who got the high grades and give you some of their points so that everybody gets a C. And I tell them, well, that's academic socialism. That's sort of an example of the incentive problem. And that's not really enough of an explanation, though. You've all learned about the calculation problem. You need private property and market prices in order to have a rational economic calculation. And so that's another cause for the ruination caused by socialism. Hayek is famous for what he called the knowledge problem, the fact that it's unthinkable that a human mind or even 100 human minds working with the most powerful computer in the world could possibly possess and utilize all of the information that the millions of workers and consumers and business managers and investors and on have that they use in their daily lives. It's a pretense. He called it the pretense of knowledge. And then there's also something I would call the public choice problem involved with socialism. The way Hayek put it was, under socialism, the only power worth having is political power. That is, the way to acquire things to make yourself better off is through politics and political connection, bribery, and just plain old politics. You can't advance by educating yourself, being a producer, being an entrepreneur, serving your fellow man by providing him or her with valued goods and services. That's illegal. That's the government is control. You're not in control. You're not allowed to do that. And so the way to succeed is through politics. And of course, the more and more people spend on politics, by definition, the less time they spend producing things. And so that extracts even more in terms of time and resources used for production in the direction of transferring what little wealth there is left into your pocket, you being the rent seeker, the rent seeking involved in politics. So you cannot fix socialism once you have it. Also under socialism, there's a famous chapter in Hayek's book, The Road to Serfdom, called Why the Worst Rise to the Top. And it made me think of something that I call the sleazometer. Where you might put people like Stalin on one end over here, maybe Chuck Schumer over here. And then, some of the nicer ones, some of the moderates, like this woman in England, she doesn't seem too horrible, Theresa May. But so that's sort of like the sleazometer with the extreme sleaze on the left side, on this side over here, and then people who are, they're still sort of coercive thugs, but they're not as bad as Stalin. But Hayek's article is, under socialism, collectivism, he was talking about collectivism in general, that it's based on using the coercive force of government to compel people to take your orders. The Mises Institute has a new T-shirt. What does it say? It says, every socialist is a secret dictator. That is certainly true. I think that's a quote from von Mises. And so, and it's all a matter of degree. You know, you had some of the socialist dictators like Stalin who were willing to murder tens of millions of people for merely dissenting. Okay. And Theresa May, as far as I know, hasn't done anything like that. But she still has inherited the accumulated vehicles of coercion that are the state, that have accumulated over hundreds of years in England. And the same thing in our government. You know, when Donald Trump was elected, he inherited the accumulated coercive powers of 200 and some years of U.S. government. And then the next person will do the same. Whoever gets elected next time will do the same. And so, and so that's always a danger. Even if you have relatively nice sounding people in power, they've got these horrible weapons at their disposal. And so the worst, you know, the absolute worst in history is something you should know about. I had some students at my university once. It was like the College Republican Club. And on the day when the students all put little tables out on the campus and they were handing out flyers about them, they took, a couple of them were taking one of my classes, and they had these statistics of mass murders by socialist governments, and they were handing out, and they told me that none of their classmates had ever heard anything about this. They never knew that a single person died because of socialism anywhere. And this is from a book called The Black Book of Communism. There's a sociologist from the University of Hawaii, Rudy Rummel, who wrote a book called Democide. Demo. And what this is not death by war. This is mass killing of people because they dissented from socialism. They did not want their property taken. They did not want to live under a tyranny. And as a result, they were murdered in mass. And these were seven French scholars who published this book about some 20 years ago, maybe more than 20 years ago now. But also Rudolf Rummel's book, what a career he had, isn't it? You know, cataloging mass killing. He spent his whole life working with statistics on mass death his whole life. He must have been pretty depressed. He wouldn't be the kind of guy you'd want to go out and have a party with. What would you talk about? So anyway, the Soviet Union, 20 million. Our friend Yuri thinks it's a low ball estimate. China, 60 million. North Korea, 2 million. Eastern Europe, 1 million. Africa, 1.7 million. And so when Hayek said the worst rise to the top, that's the sort of thing he was talking about in his day. This is in the 1940s. He was mentioning this. And so you should familiarize yourself with that. And this is not to say that Theresa May is the same as Stalin, but there's always it's all a matter of degree of coercion, isn't it? Okay. The next point is that most people don't know that fascism is a form of socialism. Fascism, socialism, communism, it's all the same gang as far as I'm concerned. They're all collectivists. After all, when I wrote this book, and I did lots of radio interviews, Regnery Publishing had me do 65 radio talk shows in a month. And so I was busy. You know, 1 o'clock in the morning, I'm on the radio with a California radio station. They own several hundred radio stations, the same company, Salem Communications. And the question I've always asked is, people would ask me, isn't communism different than socialism? And the answer is no. The Soviets, the name of their country was the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. They didn't call themselves the Union of Soviet Communist Republics. Communism was the utopian ideal that they hoped to achieve in 500 years. But in the meantime, they're all socialists. They call themselves socialists, so it's the same thing. So don't fall for that. And of course, Hayek and the Road to Serfdom point out that all the fascists of the 20th century, Mussolini, Stalin, and the rest, they all started out as socialists. And of course, the word Nazi is national socialism. So the Russians called themselves international socialists. The German socialists called themselves national socialists. But they were all socialists, just a different variety of socialism. You know, it's like, you know, I'm a murderer who likes to use guns and he likes to use knives. You know, we're the same thing. We're both murderers. We have guns, knives. What's the difference? And so, of course, another thing they had in common was the literature of the fascists all attacked liberalism, classical liberalism. And these are, you know, von Mises' book, Liberalism, which is online also and also for sale at the Mises Institute. You should all read it. These, you know, the main points, you know, what is liberalism? What are the main bullet points of classical liberalism? Private property, freedom, peace, equality under the law, inequality of income in a free market, limited government, and tolerance. These are the basic ideas that Mises lists there. These are the ideas that were attacked very voraciously by Mussolini himself and Hitler and the Nazis because they understood who the enemy was. These were the ideas and the ideas that laid the groundwork for the acceptance of markets and capitalism and private property. You can't have capitalism and private property and markets if people don't understand the virtues of it. I guess you can have it, but it's tough. It makes it a lot tougher. And so here's a few quotes about from the horse's mouth about fascism. Here's Hayek again. Hayek noted in the Road to Serfdom, he said this, the dominant feature of Nazi Germany, he's referring to Nazi Germany, was a fierce hatred of anything capitalistic, individual profit-seeking, large-scale enterprise, banks, joint stock companies, department stores, international finance and loan capital, and the system of what they called interest slavery. They equated charging you interest for a loan as slavery in general. He says, quote, the Nazis was, the common characteristic of the Nazis was their anti-liberal and anti-capitalist trend. They even adopted the slogan, quote, the end of capitalism as their accepted dogma. So that was the slogan of the Nazi ideologues that wrote about that. Mussolini said much of the same thing. I read Mussolini's autobiography once when doing some of my research. It's kind of funny. If you assigned a class of third graders and said, write a one-page autobiography. I could see the third grader writing the title, My Autobiography. That was the title of Mussolini's autobiography, My Autobiography. And I always thought it sounded sort of elementary, schoolish. But he also wrote a book called Fascism, Doctrine and Institutions. He said this, the fascist conception of life stresses the importance of the state and accepts the individual only insofar as his interests coincide with the state. It is opposed to classical liberalism, which denied the state in the name of the individual. So that it doesn't get any more clear than that, that there was an attack on classical liberalism. These ideas, you had to destroy these ideas first before you could have fascism, in the words of Benito Mussolini. He also complained about, and this is a quote, the selfish pursuit of material prosperity. He declared fascism to be a reaction against the flaccid materialistic conception of happiness and implored his audiences to, quote, reject the economistic literature of the 18th century. So don't read Adam Smith. Okay, don't read that. Sounds like the kind of thing they tell in American college campuses today. You know, don't read this stuff. You know, it's a racist, it's sexist. Adam Smith was a white guy after all. Why should we pay attention to him? That's some of the, about the level of intellectual discourse in some of the more politically correct universities. And so fascism was a variety of socialism, and the Nazis, and Mussolini's Italy were basically socialist countries. The Hayek pointed out in the Road to Serfdom that in Germany, they nationalized, the Nazis did, about half of all industry, and then the other half was so heavily regimented and controlled and regulated that it was de facto nationalized. And that's probably the big difference between Soviet socialism and the German and the Nazi socialism, is that fascism allowed a degree of private ownership, but it was heavily controlled and dictated. What it would do would be dictated by the government, by the state. So ownership was not really private ownership. Since the state controlled everything. And that is why our old friend Bob Higgs, author of the great book Crisis and Leviathan, calls the American economy today participatory fascism. He says businesses are so heavily regulated and controlled that it's like fascism was, but at least they let us vote once in a while. And so it's participatory. But Mussolini was a dictator, of course, and Hitler was a dictator, so he couldn't vote. But I guess our fascism, Bob Higgs would say, is slightly better than the Nazis and Mussolini because it's participatory. And so that's a trick politicians always play, isn't it? They want us to think that they're legitimate because, after all, we voted, which is why I never vote. One of my old essays on lewrockwell.com is entitled "Be Patriotic, Don't Vote." Okay, so that's point number five, I guess. Point number six is that inequality historically is far worse under socialism than under capitalism. If you read about Venezuela today, for example, I read an article in the Wall Street Journal that said Hugo Chavez's daughter, who's in her 30s, has a net worth of about $4 billion. And as far as I know, she never started a business. I don't think she's one of the original founders of Microsoft or anything like that. And $4 billion. And the Wall Street Journal also said that the former finance minister of Venezuela, who I think they said he now lives in Switzerland, had a net worth of $11 billion. Okay. And of course, even to this day, you can read articles in the American news media about the political elite in Venezuela still living high on the hog. They have their country clubs and they have their food. And you also read about people killing dogs and cats to feed their children, you know, the ordinary people in Venezuela. And it's always been like that. The people who ran the Soviet Union had multiple vacation homes all over the place and accumulated great wealth, and the masses were equally indigent. And country after country, you see that. The African potentates who adopted socialism and became dictators after independence in the 1960s, they all lived like kings and queens. While the people starved. And so the whole business of we need socialism to create more equality is fraudulent. It's never been true like that. Not that equality is even a desirable thing, because of course we're all different. We're all different in thousands of different ways. And the only way you can move in the direction of trying to force equality is with a totalitarian society. And of course, you can never do that. You can never have equality because human beings are not equal. As Rabbi Daniel Lappin, who gave a talk here some years ago on this point, he said that he made the point that, you know, God made all human beings. This is a Jewish rabbi. He said God made all human beings unique, just like he made all stones unique. Stones are all different. Every stone is different. You can't find two stones that are the same. But humans can make bricks identical. We can manufacture bricks, you know, like the bricks in a house or a building. You can make those identical. And he posed the question, do you want to think of yourself more as a stone or a brick? And that's what egalitarianism is about, is making us all into identical bricks, even if it kills us. And, you know, where's my list of mass murder there? That's always been the idea, even if it kills us. Okay. Point number seven, the income tax is the essence of socialism. The income, especially the progressive income tax. This is why in the Communist Manifesto, there's a 10 plank of the Communist Manifesto, 10 points. Point number one says abolition of private property. Point number two is a heavy progressive income tax. Okay. Now, of course, economists, the Austrians and others, have studied the income tax. You know, it increases the rate of time preference and destroys the work effort and has all these bad effects. But it has another effect as well. And I want to read a short quote about that from Frank Chodorov. One of the great books ever written on the income tax is The Income Tax, Root of All Evil by Frank Chodorov, which is for sale downstairs at the bookstore, I noticed this morning. And here's something he said. He said, when the progressive income tax was adopted in 1913, this is in the United States, the absolute right of private property in the United States was violated. That, of course, is the essence of socialism. Whatever else socialism is or is claimed to be, its first tenet is the denial of private property. Well, it's in the Communist Manifesto. This is why all socialists, beginning with Karl Marx, have advocated income taxation, the heavier the better. And so that's certainly very true. And also, to have socialism, so, you know, the socialists of the world always want a centralized governmental power. They can't allow divided sovereignty or federalism or states' rights, whatever you want to call it, devolution of power. They want centralized power. And nothing in the United States history, anyway, it's, nothing gave us centralized governmental bureaucracy more than the income tax and the Fed. And so, and they both happened in the same year, in 1913. And so the socialists of the world knew what they were doing. And they know what they're doing when they're so worshipful about the income tax, because it centralizes power and it basically tells you that you don't own the income that you earn. The government owns all of your income. You are a slave to the government, and the government will tell you how much of your income you are allowed to keep by setting the tax rates. You know, it's our income, and we will tell you how much you get to keep. And so Chodorov, I think, was right on the money when he wrote that. And the only reason they don't, of course, make the rates even higher, they always try to maximize the rates, is they do understand that we will cheat on our taxes and we will stop working, and we might even have an armed revolution if they steal, you know, if they make us destitute by confiscating too much of our income. So even the people who are on my sleazometer, have to be careful about that, because as Rothbard wrote in quite a few places, and it reminded us that any state in the world is greatly outnumbered by millions and millions of people. And so any state is always just a relatively small group of people. And so they always run the risk of a revolution or a violent revolution. That's why they spend so many resources on propaganda and indoctrination. It's sort of a way to quell revolutionary impulses on the cheap. They don't always use violence to put down revolutions. The indoctrination and propaganda is also a tool that is very essential there. Okay. Point number eight, the Scandinavian countries are about as socialist as the United States is. One of the myths out there that crazy Bernie has been spreading is that we need to be more like Sweden. We need to be more like Denmark. These Scandinavian countries are more socialist, you know, democratic socialism. He says there's a huge difference between socialism and democratic socialism. And he usually spells huge with about 15 or 20 U's in it when you see him on television doing that. But take a look at this. This is, there's something called the Index of Economic Freedom. It's published by several different groups. The Fraser Institute in Canada publishes one, Fraser.org, F-R-A-S-E-R.org. The Heritage Foundation publishes one. This is one from the Heritage Foundation. They put together an index of economic freedom. Basically, the more every country in the world is ranked, and if the more, in their opinion, that you safeguard private property, the rule of law, minimal government, minimal regulations, lower taxes, you get a higher rating. And so they come up with an index number for every country. And this is the latest rankings here. The U.S. ranking is, I think the United States is 12th. And the number, the index number is 76.8. Denmark is 76.7. So we're about as socialist as Denmark. Sweden and Finland, pretty close, pretty much the same. So we're pretty much, you know, they're hardly can be said to be more socialist than the United States. The top ranking goes to Hong Kong, 90.2, just to give you an idea of how far away the U.S. and the Scandinavian countries are. Singapore, 89.2. I think what Crazy Bernie is referring to is Sweden in the 1950s. In the 1940s, the Swedes became sort of infatuated with fascist planning. And then fascism kind of got a bad name after the Hitler thing, and so they ditched that. But they sort of adopted their own version of socialism and nationalized a lot of industries, very heavy taxes, big welfare state. And according to the Swedish Academy of Economics, Sweden did not create a single net new job from 1950 until 2005. So for 55 years, there was zero job growth in Sweden. And Sweden produced, let me get the statistic here. They did the same thing these other countries did. They tried to inflate their way out of the mess they had created. And in the 1980s, they had 500% interest rates in Sweden. And so, and that's when Sweden, the Swedish government began to retrench. They privatized a lot of their industries, including a big part of healthcare, and moved in the other direction. So that's why today they're pretty close to the United States in terms of their ranking. But they pretty much destroyed. They did exactly what Mises said about destructionism. They lived off the past efforts and investments and sacrifices of the great Swedish capitalists of the late 19th and early 20th century that produced a lot of great things for the world, and then and ruined it basically. Okay, so the Sweden, Denmark, Finland, they have private enterprise. These are still primarily capitalist countries with a big welfare state, just like the United States. We are still primarily a capitalist country. We have private enterprises, but we have a much bigger welfare state than the Scandinavian countries do. And so it doesn't make sense to say we need to be more like them, more socialistic. We already are. Point number nine, running out of time here. Socialism has caused the worst pollution problems in the history of the world, at least the modern history of the world. After the collapse of communism in the late 80s and early 90s, all of a sudden, all of these closed totalitarian societies opened up, and people could look around and learn a lot of things, including the state of the environment over there. Now, at the time, any student had studied economics was taught that the root cause of pollution is unregulated free market competition. The story that you're all told is that industrialists will take into consideration the private cost to them. They have to pay wages and they have to pay for raw materials, but they won't take into consideration the external cost in terms of the pollution and the damage it might cause to your health or to your property or something like that. And therefore, they will produce too much, and the government needs to step in and regulate and control production to do that. Well, if that theory is true, then what would you expect the environment to look like in countries that outlawed the pursuit of profit for 50, 60, 70 years? If the pursuit of profit is the root cause of pollution, and then you have a society that outlaws the pursuit of profit, the legal pursuit of profit, for half a century, what would you expect the environment to look like in those countries? You expect it to be pristine, after all, if that's the root cause. Well, the exact opposite turned out to be the truth. And there were even books published with titles like Ecocide in the USSR. And this is true not just in the Soviet Union and under communism, but Venezuela today, Lake Maracaibo, I'm not sure that's how you pronounce it. Hundreds of tons of untreated sewage flow into it every day. When British Petroleum had that awful accident in the Gulf of Mexico, an oil platform caught on fire, people died, they immediately set aside $20 billion to pay compensation because they knew they were going to have to pay compensation. Well, Mexico, the government of Mexico, their oil platforms catch on fire all the time. And this is the government-run business. And whenever that happens, they deny any liability. They even denied that there was an oil slick. There was one about 7 or 8 years ago, and they denied that there was any kind of oil slick or environmental damage. And then Greenpeace took a satellite image of the oil slick that was created by the Mexican government's oil platform. And so so you have a situation there where the capitalists took responsibility for the horrible accident. And then when the Mexican government has an almost identical horrible accident, I don't think anybody, certainly nobody wanted this to happen. They deny being liable at all. And so if you look at the history of what happened in the socialist countries, they ruined their their environments far more than anything we've seen in the United States. In Russia, the Volga River, the steamboats had signs on them saying, don't throw cigarettes overboard, the river may catch on fire. They almost wiped out the sturgeon population. In Poland, people with lung disease were sent to underground uranium mines for as health clinics. The fire trucks would have to go through the streets several times a day in the industrial part of Poland, knocking the lead dust out of the air from the factories. I have an old friend who grew up in former Yugoslavia, and he worked for the government, so he was a government lawyer. Ivan Pangrasic, some of you, the old timers here know who he was. His son is an Austrian school economist, and they both were. But anyway, he came to this country, but he told me once he lived in a 30th floor apartment in Zagreb, and I asked him, why 30th floor? And he said, there's no elevator in the building. And I said, what, are you a mountain climber? Or what are you, a physical fitness fanatic? What is it? He said, no, the pollution is so bad that you can't see, if you're below the 20th floor, you can't open your windows because you'll die from the lead and cadmium and zinc dust that comes in your house all day long. Can't do that. And so it was pretty awful. And under socialism. And so, I have a whole chapter on that, so you can read the book. I guess the final thing I'll say is welfare harms the poor. And I'm running out of time. So, socialist welfare harms the poor. So I'm going to read you one thing about, and there's a lot of literature about how the welfare destroys work incentives, causes family breakup, and so forth. And I'm going to read one thing about what an extreme welfare state in Sweden has done to the Swedish people. And this is from our friend Per Bylund, who's an Austrian school economist. He's lectured here many times. He's a friend of ours. He's a Swedish, he's a Swede, but he works, I think he's at Oklahoma State University now. He said this, I'm quoting Per, when handling out benefits and therefore taking away the individual's responsibility for his or her own life, a new kind of individual is created, the immature, irresponsible, and dependent. The welfare state has created a population of psychological and moral children. The children and grandchildren of the welfare state are indoctrinated at an early age in the government schools that they have a supposed right to free education, health care, and income, and anything else they might desire. And of course, when you say that, that means somebody else has the obligation to be your slave, to work for you. And my old friend Walter Williams, when he gives his one of his canned speeches, I've had him in my university several times, he kind of shocks some of the students by asking them this question. He says, what would you call a system in which one person is forced with the threats of imprisonment, kidnapping and imprisonment, to work for the benefit of another person? And it usually takes about 5 seconds for someone to say what? What would you say?
Slavery.
Slavery, yeah. And then, of course, he describes the welfare state. And what else would you call that when the average American works until May now to pay taxes, mostly for the benefit of other people? What would you call that? And that's what the welfare state has done. And I guess my time is up, and coffee break time. Thank you.